life of spiritual discipline is one of constant vigilance over the small details, not only of one's thoughts and states of consciousness, but also of one's daily conduct and reaction. Spiritual seekers generally are likely to be carried away by a notion of the big and the large as the ideal of the spiritual quest, while forgetting in a state of untutored ignorance that details, the small units of practice, are going to make up the large achievement of the spiritual goal. Among the majority of cases, a failure to achieve success in spiritual life can be attributed purely to an over-enthusiasm in respect of the large and the distant, while completely being oblivious of what is under one's own nose. Because the object of our quest in the spiritual field is something unique and not capable of being equated with the objects which we are generally accustomed to see with our eyes or perceive with our senses. It is next to impossibility for an uninitiated mind to comprehend the extent and the magnitude of the details of spiritual practice. The goal, which is the realization of the spirit, is intimately related to the processes that are involved in the practice. As it is usually said, the end that we are going to achieve is nothing but the culmination of the evolution of the means that we are adopting in the practice. The fruit that we enjoy from a tree is the finale of a long process of the evolution of what we call the tree, arisen from the seed, from incipient stage of invisibility and comparative unimportance. You know how large, strong and spacious is the tree, and how delicious is the fruit that it yields. But all this has come from a relatively insignificant factor that we call a small seed, which we are likely to cast away without much value or meaning being attached to it. But unfortunately, the small seed has been the mother, which has been nurturing this spacious tree and embodying within its bosom the luscious fruit which delights the senses of man. It is therefore no use merely gazing at the possibility of having a large tree and delicious fruit without paying any attention to the factor of the seed involved in it, because without the seed there is no tree, and without the tree there is no fruit. Notwithstanding the fact that seed is very small and not of much worth, the timber of the tree is so costly, but the small seed has no such value. Yet the tree and timber has come from this seed. But for the seed there would have been no tree. In a similar manner, we may say that the vast achievement of spiritual realization, the yoga siddhi, perfection in the practice of yoga, which is so attractive and so very charming, so enrapturing even to think, is constituted of very fine, subtle factors which come before us every day, but which we totally ignore as not connected with the goal of our realization. But this is a mistake. The goal is not far from us, it is not a distant ideal, spatially disconnected from us, so that we can cut off the means from the end. We cannot sever the relationship between the end and the means. And the relationship between the means and the end here in this particular context is more intimate than the connection that you usually see between temporal means and temporal ends. You work hard and earn a good salary. Earning a good salary is the end, and the working hard for it is the means. Now there is some sort of connection, you may say, between working hard and acquiring a good salary. But this connection is not vital, not a living relation, but a made-up connection in a social pattern of understanding and arrangement of things. And the connection between work and the fruit of the work in the form of salary or wages is not an organic tie between the two, but an accepted connection due to a social rule that we have made to prevail under certain principles adopted in common. But the relation between the spiritual means and the spiritual goal is not a merely contrived relation in a social sense or a mechanic relationship, but a living, growing, vital process of inseparable links in a chain of living forces. The connection between the body of a child and the body of the same child grown into an adult is organic. It is not a mechanical relationship. The same thing has come up into this present condition of growth, expanded in various aspects, but containing within this expanded form the vitality of the original condition which preceded this stage years back. The practice of spirituality is constituted of organic units, all related to one another in an inseparable bond of spirituality again. The relationship of these units also is spiritual. And the more you advance in the path of the spirit, the more will you be able to realize that things are essentially spiritual and not material, physical, or externally related. The lower we are in the strata of evolution, the more physical and more external do things appear to us. And the more distant is the relation between the means and the end. That is why we try to cheat people, be dishonest, and be one thing inside and another thing outside, under the notion that the end and the means are not connected to each other. Because if you are dishonest, a bad result may not follow from it. This is our belief. We can deceive without being deceived. This notion is the cause behind malpractices in personal life as well as in social life of people. But this is a grave error of thought. There is a connection between the means and the end. So you cannot be one thing inside and another thing outside. This will not work. Because what you are inside is the means, and what you are outside cannot be completely unconnected with it, though you try to be different. The rule of nature, the law of the cosmos is so constituted that the seed must grow into the structure that is already inherent in it. It cannot grow something else. You cannot expect an elephant to come out of a mango shell. It is impossible. It is only a tendril of a mango plant that will come out of it. But ignorant as man is, in spite of his so-called qualifications, he is bankrupt in the understanding of natural laws that prevail in the world, which work throughout the layers of the cosmos. What paves the way to the particular conduct of a person is also going to be the factor contributing to the manifestation of its inherent nature. More cautious than ordinary people in the world should a spiritual seeker be, because law operates more strictly in the case of a spiritual seeker than in the case of ordinary persons. The reactions set up by natural forces in respect of spiritual seekers are more immediate and more vehement than in the case of people who are thick-skinned or buffalo-skinned, as you would call them. The reason is the subtlety of thought and the greater capacity to receive the reaction from forces of nature. It does not mean that the forces of nature do not react in the case of other persons, but the sensitivity of normal people, ordinary people, is much less than the sensitivity of spiritual seekers, and so they feel the rebuff of it much more quickly than other people in the world. Hence, any palpable achievement in the field of spiritual work and spiritual sadhana can be expected only if we take care of the pennies, as they say, if we have to see that the pounds also are taken care of. Because the pounds are made up of pennies. You don't have pounds by themselves. Thus, the large fruit of God realization, yoga, siddhi, atma sakshatkara, spiritual perfection, is nothing but the evolution into perfection of the methodology that we are adopting in our day-to-day life. We cannot say that today we can be fools and tomorrow we can be wise people. That is not possible. Because what we are today is going to affect what we are going to be tomorrow. It is a connection which is inseparable. The day-to-day practice and conduct of the spiritual seeker, therefore, is most important of vital consequence. Now, what is going to be the method that the spiritual seeker is to adopt in one's daily life? Generally, we as beginners in the path of yoga make a distinction between temporal life and spiritual life. Which means to say that we bifurcate between the time of our spiritual sadhana in a particular day and our secular activities or temporal duties of the world. Under the notion, very important to underline, that the temporal activity of yours is not connected with your spiritual sadhana of a day, of an hour or two. You may be meditating for half an hour and doing japa for 1.5 hours and reading scripture for half an hour in your closet, in your puja room, and then you get up and enter a new world altogether of an activity unconnected with, unrelated to the little period of sadhana in which we are engaged. Now we cannot help getting into this rut of erroneous thinking, which has to be carefully obviated by trained thinking. It is impossible to make such bifurcation in our life, because life is a continuity. Though the work that you do at two different times may be distinct in character, in makeup, you are the same person that does the two different work. This cannot be forgotten. You may rob Peter and pay Paul. You think paying Paul is a charitable act, but robbing Peter is the opposite of it. Now there seems to be a feeling that there is no connection between robbing Peter and paying Paul, but there is a connection, because you have been the person that has done both these acts. They will be connected, and you cannot simply bifurcate them as if they are actions of two different individuals themselves. The spiritual contemplative mood and attitude of worship which we entertain for a very meager part of the day as our spiritual sadhana is generally mistakenly isolated from our business, commercial and temporal relations. This we do on the supposition that these two sides of our nature have internally no relationship, which is a blunder. This is a flounder in our thinking. They will mutually react between each other, like acid and alkali, and a chemical reaction will be set up, so that the temporal activity, the secular duties, may receive the impact of your good thoughts entertained during the period of worship and meditation. Not that this will not happen, it will happen, but there will also be the other side of it. The thought that you entertain during your period of worship and mood of meditation will also receive the impact of your temporal activity. While the spiritual concept may influence your temporal duty, your commercial thoughts also can be entertained during your spiritual contemplation. Because you are the same person, same mind, same thought, same feeling that is behind these two sides of your nature and work. It is therefore essential to pave the background of spiritual practice before we actually set our foot into it. The universe is a single whole, it is not a divided house, like a human body. You cannot have half the body of one kind and another half of another kind. The whole body is single, connected, whole. Then you have half the body enjoying health and another half full of disease with the chronic illness. That is not possible. It is one whole, compact, living organism. Such is life, such is the world, such is creation as a completeness. So the laws of nature will work as a reaction from the total, from the whole, rather than from merely a part. It is the whole of nature that reacts when any reaction sets up. It is not only a part of nature that works. The nature will not work in part, because there is no such thing as part of nature. Just as we have no such thing as part of a living body, it is one complete whole. Any reaction from a part of the body is the whole body reacting. So, from this analogy, we may have to draw the conclusion that we have to be prepared to encounter natural laws in their wholeness, and also remember that the very same natural laws operate in our personal life, in our family life, and our social life. Nature has no within and without. You cannot say nature is outside and it is not inside your house, within your family, and inside your own body. Nothing of the kind. Nature is a term that we apply to the way in which the total creation works, of which you are a part. So it is inside the family, inside the body, inside the temple, inside the bathroom, inside the whole cosmos. Everywhere. And the same law will work inexorably, without remission of effort, in respect of every person, high or low, at all times, without any distinction whatsoever. So, it is foolish on our part to make a distinction between the spiritual and the temporal. Such a distinction does not exist in nature. It cannot exist even for God. I don't think that God will make a distinction between temporal and spiritual. It is one whole law working through the body, through the vital forces, through the senses, through the mind, through the intellect, in society and in nature, in the stellar system, everywhere. This is the Satya Dharma. Satya Dharmaya Drishtaye, says the Ishavasya Upanishad. The law of truth. The Satya Dharma which the Ishavasya Upanishad speaks of is the law of truth, which is single, universal, inexorable, incapable of division into inside and outside, into the temporal and the spiritual, into the commercial and the adhyatmic, nothing of the kind. So, we have to take a total view of things in our spiritual life, because truth has no distinction of spirit and matter. It is our mind that makes this distinction. Matter outside, spirit within, and so on. There is no such distinction for truth. Truth as it is in itself is neither matter nor spirit as we think of them. It is something transcending both concepts. And it appears as matter from one angle of vision, as spirit from another point of view. So there will be an action from both matter and spirit simultaneously when any action takes place. Any event is a total joint activity of spirit and matter combined. The within and the without act together. Now this is a secret which most people do not know, cannot understand, and therefore people make a mistake in their performances, not only in spiritual sadhana, but also even in lesser duties such as in factories, in offices, etc. Remember again, nature has no office, factory, etc. It does not exist for it. Nature has no business activity. Nature has no temples and bathrooms and so on. They don't exist for nature. They exist for our mind. So what ultimately works is the natural law and not what is in our heads. Though for us there is a distinction between a temple and a bathroom, for nature no such difference exists. It has no difference of any kind in any manner whatsoever. And its law only operates everywhere. So this is something very startling and even shaking us from our nerves if we deeply think of it. Nature is impersonal, not a human being like us, who has emotions of a father, mother, child, etc. These emotions are not psychological functions. They are eternal principles which work in a child and an adult equally, in a man and a woman, in a learned and a stupid. Unanimously, uniformly it will work,
without any partiality. Such being the case, the difference between spiritual and temporal is unknown to fact as such. And inasmuch as it is this fact that operates finally, it is this law that works in the end. It would be wisdom on our part to be abiding by this law. We should not violate this law, imagining that we do not understand it. Ignorance of law is no excuse. You cannot say, I don't know it. You have to know it if you are a citizen of the world. The law of the spirit is also the law of matter. The law of the within is also the law of the without. The law of your personal life is also the law of nature. The law of spirituality is the law also of business. They are not two different things. What works in one place will work in other place also. But we generally make a very glib distinction between these two levels and aspects of work for purpose of convenience. But we are talking of serious matters and not mere conveniences and comforts of the human mind. What may be convenient to you may not be in conformity with the justice of nature. And so this convenience can be wiped out completely from its surface when the law begins to work. So we have to take a very comprehensive view of our life and remember that we are part of a living set of principles or laws which we have to take into consideration in our spiritual and temporal works, not making a dichotomy between the two, but regarding both as two aspects of a single nature. So, what you are in your business center, in your office or your factory, cannot be a totally different attitude from what you entertained in your puja room. That cannot be. Though the methodology of your external manipulation of work may differ, the attitude cannot differ. While you may wave an arati in your puja room, you may tighten a screw in your factory. That is the difference. You don't wave an arati in the factory, nor you run a dynamo in your puja room. They are different in outer methodology or implementation of the technique. But the attitude cannot be totally different. And the ultimate goal and the purpose of your work cannot be demarcated in watertight compartment. The spirit behind your work is the attitude of the work, and that is the sadhana, that is what is going to pave the way to success. A totally unspiritual attitude cannot succeed even in business, because there is no such thing as unspiritual business in the world. It is connected to every other factor in the world. As a digression, I may tell you, black marketeers will not succeed. You may think that that is essential in this world, but you will have to reap the consequences. Like a thunderbolt, it will come one day or the other. Your son may go mad. His cancer may develop. Heart may fail, and you may have to pay heavy income tax by error of calculation, maybe. These things you cannot take as jokes. They are serious matters. Those who take bribes in a clandestine manner and build bungalows and purchase land have mostly seen that their sons are out of their brains. No treatment will work. But they cannot connect one with the other. You think this is something different, that is something different. It is not so. There is no clandestine activity in nature. Everything is public. You cannot secretly work in nature. Remember, again, to pinpoint this principle, nature has no secret and it has no public life separately isolated from its secret activity. God works through nature. What you call nature, the world, the universe is the face of God smiling and frowning before you at different times. God speaks to us in the language of nature, through the trees, through the animals, through the wind that blows, through the river that flows, the sun that shines, and He will react through different faces, in different manners, in consonance with the total law that has to operate as the guiding principle of everyone. We are humans, we are omniscient, and therefore we are unable to connect one thing with another thing. We always think that one particular aspect of our life is unconnected with another particular aspect of life. And therefore it is that we are failures both in our spiritual life and our practical outer life. Spiritually we are nothing, and in outer life also we do not succeed, because we have separated the two aspects of our life. Life is one flow, and you cannot say this is this and that is that. This and that are connected. Everything that you do will have an impact on what your essential nature is. Whether it is done in respect of some other person and some other thing, or in respect of your own self. Again, I should say that nature has no you and I. He, she, it. These things do not exist for nature. They are our concepts, our notions working within our brain. I, you, he, she, it are non-existent for nature. And therefore, a wind will blow over everyone's face in the same manner. Whether it is I or you or he or she or it, it makes no difference. The wind of the law of nature will blow equally on all people's faces and extract the same levy from everyone. Thus, it becomes imperative on the part of a spiritual sadhaka to be conscious and cautious of his or her daily conduct, behavior and attitude to things in general. You cannot smile before one and frown at another unless you are able to connect the two together in an organic relationship. If there is a difficulty in bringing about this relation between the two aspects of our work and nature, we will be the losers and no one else. Thus, the foundation of spiritual life should be well thought out and laid before we tread the path of the Spirit. It is the basic rock foundation upon which we have to build the edifice of our future, both in the form of practice and achievement. Now, the foundation of spiritual life being so totally construed and being a whole in itself has therefore to be laid by due consideration being as bestowed on all the factors that are going to make up this practice. What are the factors that constitute spiritual practice?
Every blessed thing is a part of it. Your diet, your drink, the kind of sleep that you are having, the place where you sleep, the kind of work that you do, the way in which you speak, the way in which you think, the thoughts that you are entertaining in your mind, the emotions that you have, the feelings that you are hiding from others, the secret desires that you are entertaining, fulfilled as well as unfulfilled, the relationships that you have with other people, the idea that you have about others, living or non-living, all these things constitute units in the practice of sadhana. How many things? You would have to note down all these points in your diary and try to assemble them like a mechanic fitting up a machine. They are all essential, so they are thousand in number. What is your idea about other people? You answer this question to yourself. When you look around and see people, what do you think about them? What do you think about these many things that you see in front? This has connection with your progress. Because what you think about others is only a manifestation of what you are at present. Because what is not within you cannot come out. Your present state of evolution is responsible for the attitude that you are developing in respect of persons and things at a given moment of time. From this you can have a judgment of your own worth and status in life and the stage of progress that has been made. Every little bit of our conduct outward and inward therefore is contributory to spiritual progress, because this is precisely what we call spiritual practice. The moment you think, you have to think comprehensively through all these aspects. If you take one morsel of food, put it into the stomach, the entire organism begins to work. It is not that only the stomach begins to work. Every part of the physiological system begins to work because of the internal relationship among the parts. Likewise, when a single act of spiritual sadhana is set into motion, all the other factors contributory also begin to take part in it. And if they are ignored, they will set up an adverse reaction. These are what we call the obstacles in spiritual sadhana. Ignored factors setting up a reaction in vehemence against you. This is what we call pratibandhakas or obstacles in meditation, etc. Otherwise, there will be no obstacle in meditation. The ignored person is your enemy. It is very clear. But if you not ignore any person, take into consideration everyone and everything, you will be a friend of all and everything. Reactions will not be set up. So internal reactions and outward impacts, which we sometimes experience in an adverse manner, are due to the operation or work of factors which we have forgotten and ignored in our life. Otherwise, there should be no such thing as real obstacle in sadhana. If you ignore a particular aspect of the dietetic discipline of your life, you know what will happen to you. You might have considered many aspects, but few of them have been forgotten. You should not eat a square meal at midnight. But you will forget that aspect and do everything else. And that particular aspect ignored will have a reaction. Next morning you will have 102. Then you run to Dr. Aruna or this person, that person and all that. So because you have forgotten a simple factor, that midnight you should not have a square meal,
Who told you this? But everything else you have followed, all the rules, you have sat properly, munched properly, swallowed properly, everything. But you have done it at the wrong time. This is only to give a visible example of our errors. A small factor ignored in spiritual sadhana can set up a vehement reaction and come upon our head like a bolt from the blue. And we will not know what has happened to us. Hence it is essential to go slowly but firmly. Don't be impatient in your practice. Because a well thought out plan, though it has taken a long time, will work better than an ill conceived plan which has been done in haste. Don't be very eager to do things quickly, but be eager to see that you have thought things properly, considering all aspects of matter, seeing that no reactions are set up from any ignored aspect. Now these factors to be considered in spiritual life are important, which we have to ponder deeply. Generally, during the period of initiation by a guru, the master is supposed to tell you all these difficulties and details of spiritual practice. Yet, it is important enough for the individual concerned. A certain amount of philosophical thinking is essential for a spiritual seeker. Philosophy not in the sense of an academic research or a scientific treatise or a thesis, not in that sense, but philosophy in the sense of correct comprehensive thinking is indispensable for a spiritual seeker, because philosophy is nothing but comprehensive thinking. Philosophy does not mean Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, not necessarily. These are only forms of philosophy. But the principles of philosophy imply comprehensive thinking. Impartial comprehensive thinking is called philosophy. And if you have ignored any aspect, you are not a good philosopher. Then it is that you will be able to do the right thing at the right moment of time. You have to do the right thing at the right time in the right manner. For this you require a comprehensive knowledge of the factors of your work, which is called philosophical principle. So a spiritual seeker should be, to some extent at least, a good philosopher. Impartial, comprehensive thinking is philosophy. You cannot avoid this. And based on this philosophy is the psychology of human nature. The spiritual seeker has to be a very good psychologist, because psychology is implied in philosophy. The mental factor involved in the operation of the principles of philosophy is called psychology. So philosophy and psychology go together as inseparable brothers or sisters. It is essential, therefore, to learn the science of thinking. You should not think chaotically, unconnectedly, without regard to the pros and cons of the aspects of the matter. So, first thing would be to be well grounded in scientific, philosophical thinking in an impartial manner, and then to understand the psychology involved in it. It is psychology that leads to practice. So these are internally related organic parts of the spiritual life of a person. Philosophical foundation, psychological analysis, and actual practice of methodology. This is a complete system of education for spiritual name. But generally, we are untutored in this field. We have no knowledge. And therefore, we lack in the application of the right effort. You may sweat, fret and fume and work very hard without proper knowledge. And then you should not complain if the result does not follow. It is not merely action that is important, but right action that is important. So it is no use one being too busy from morning to evening without being proper in that being busy. And therefore, to understand the rectitude or the justification of the action in its proper context, one has to understand the background of this action. So again, here again we have a completeness of structure. The scientific foundation, the psychological analysis, and the technique of practice. If you consider all these aspects of life, of which a bare outline I have tried to place before you, you will be intensely cautious before you entertain a single thought in your mind. Because thoughts are things and thoughts are actions. They are not different. They will work like things. Thought can redound upon you like a large stone falling on your head. Thoughts have weight, dimension, and they can act all substances. And they are forces which will not go without producing an action. Like Ramabana, once it is let out, it must find a target. It won't keep quiet. So before you entertain a thought, it is better to analyze the foundation of this thought and think slowly, think lesser number of thoughts than think many things in a haste. So every thought will produce an impression. It will produce sanskara and impel you to a particular kind of activity in respect of a target or object. Once the seed is sown, you have no control over the nature of the plant that comes out of it. You have freedom to sow the particular seed that you want. That much of freedom is with you. You can choose what kind of seed you have to sow. But once you have sown it, it has gone out of your control. You cannot command the seed to project forth some other plant altogether other than what is inherent in it. So to choose a particular thinking, a thought, entertain an attitude, emotion or feeling may be said to be your freedom of choice. But once you have let out this force in the form of a thought or a feeling, it will produce its reaction. And the reaction will come upon us like a boomerang if it has been an ill-directed one. This is what is called samsara, bandhana and bondage, the cause of rebirth. Our own thoughts, feelings and emotions coming back upon us and demanding their dues from us. It is told that as a small calf will find its own mother in the midst of a large herd of cattle by wriggling through the various cows in a large group, somewhere that it will find its own mother, wherever the mother is, so your karma will find you, wherever you are. It won't leave you. You may go to the distant heaven, it will come and tell you, I am here. So we cannot escape this law, which is God's law working universally, impartially, inexorable. If we are honest about results in spiritual practice, we must also be honest in the correct application of the method. We cannot be rogues inside and saints outside. If you have to be a saint outside, you have naturally be a saint inside also. How can be a cutthroat within and a philanthropist outside? Not possible. This kind of law, this kind of method will not work. So, it is useless to imagine that we can be spiritual in our temple and a church and a puja room and unspiritual in the field of work, in street, in business, in shop. If that sort of wrong thought is entertained, we will be losers. We will not gain either here nor there. For a spiritual seeker, life is a single continuity. He has no inside and outside difference. He does not make a distinction between the spiritual and the temporal. What he thinks within, he thinks without. Because he knows the seed and the tree are connected to each other. So this is the principle that I wanted to enunciate before you today. The law of continuity of life in all the planes of existence, life which has no within and without, no external, no internal, no spirit and no matter distinction. And therefore, it is essential that we undergo a special type of training for thinking in this manner, so that it may be to our benefit and advantage. What we need is a new type of education. A new tutoring is essential. We have been brought up under erroneous circumstances and given wrong education from our childhood. We have always been taught to do tit for tat. This is the law of the world. But tit will bring tit, tat and will bring tat. But tit will not bring tat. That is not the law of nature. There is continuity. This principle we cannot forget. Manasyekam vajasyekam karmanyekam mahatmanam. The great soul is one continuity of flow in thought, in speech and in action. You cannot hide. In nature no hiding is allowed. Every secret thought of yours will be like a thunderstorm vibrating throughout the cosmos. It is as if a microphone is set up everywhere. Thus it is that we have to be in our simple daily life in a microscopic manner what we want to be in the ultimate end of our life. If our goal is to behold God, we have to be godly in our daily life also. We cannot be devils inside and expect to see God afterwards. So divinity has to be the force that charges every cell of our body and mind. Divinity should be the power that influences every thought and emotion and the feeling of ours. Divinity should be the foundation of our total life of any particular day, if divinity is going to be the goal of our realization. Because, again, to tell you, the seed and the tree are connected. The small items of our life, therefore, are thought, speech and action. To put it in a nutshell, all the items and various factors of a daily life of the individual are thought, speech and action. What do you think, what do you speak and how do you act? What is the internal connection among these three items? This has to be properly weighed every day and balance sheet struck before you go to bed every night. The debit and the credit side have to be seen properly. What have I thought today? What have I spoken? And what have I done? You strike a balance sheet and see the assets and debits. Do you stand to debit or credit before you go to bed? And let there be a clean balance sheet every day when you go to bed. It was only yesterday, in giving satsang, I was murmuring to some colleague of mine, in some context, that a great saint had said, never go to bed with the idea that you will get up in the morning. Is it not a joke also, it's a serious matter. Who tells you that tomorrow you will get up? You will not get up. So when you go to bed today, clear the account completely. Whatever is paid has been paid. Don't say tomorrow I will pay. You may not be here tomorrow. So every day your account should be closed. And you must go with the credit to your side and not with the debit. If the debit is there, you will be reborn to pay that debt. And you don't want rebirth, you want moksha, salvation. So how can you live in such a miserable, constricted manner every day and expect a large realization afterwards? So the point to be emphasized is that little things make big things. The small units of your daily activity and conduct are what are going to contribute to the large realization of your goal later on. So be a good person, speak good words, do good deeds, so that they may not produce a reaction against you. Anything that is selfish produces a reaction. All selfish thoughts, feelings, emotions and actions will produce a reaction adversely upon that person who is the source of this thought, feeling, speech or action. So if we suffer, we have to blame our own self. If we undergo any kind of pain, it is due to our own making. Nobody else is responsible. Your bondage and your liberation are in your hands. You can go to hell or heaven as you like. It is in your control completely. And therefore, a spiritual seeker is apramattaha tada bhavati yogohi prabhavapyayo, says the Kathopanishad. A yogi, a spiritual seeker is cautious always. He will not take one step without thinking, where is me? He will not run far in the wrong direction. He will not take a step at all, it is not clear. So, vigilant is the seeker. Uniform is his thought, speech and action. And a continuity is maintained between his spiritual and temporal duties. And he is conscious always that God is within his own soul. And therefore, the soul evolves into God. Something else cannot come out from within oneself. Thus is the background or the foundation we have to lay in our spiritual life philosophically, psychologically and technically in practice. This is the art of spiritual living, the science of spiritual conduct, the technique of yoga, which is movement of our consciousness from a lesser whole to a larger whole. We move from whole to whole. We do not move from part to part or from part to whole. At every stage of our life we are in a completeness, though it may be small in its gamut or manifestation. A child is a whole personality, an adult is a whole personality, an old man is a whole personality. You cannot say child is a part. It is a whole. Even an earthworm is a hole by itself. An elephant also is a hole by itself. Everything is a hole. Life is a hole, manifesting itself as a whole in every unit of itself. Something very interesting, very difficult to conceive, but imperative and incapable of ignorance on its part. This is the science of life in its outline. Most important, remember, very significant for daily contemplation, and the only factor that is going to pave the way to your ultimate success in any field of your activity. Hari Om Tat Sat.